Hello and welcome to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, coming to you live from our studio in London. We'll start this edition with a deeper look at what's going on in Syria. The sudden collapse of Bashar al-Assad's regime there has been compared to the Middle East equivalent of the fall of the Berlin Wall. In Damascus, Syria's new government is already starting to take shape. The rebel leader, Abu Muhammad al-Julani, has appointed the man who's been running most of the rebel-held Idlib province as the country's interim prime minister. And the new authorities in Damascus have announced that senior officials of the deposed Assad regime, who tortured political prisoners, will be brought to justice. Robert Ford is a former American ambassador to Syria. He told the BBC the new leadership of Syria was facing challenges.
I'm hopeful that the Syrians will be able to put together some kind of coalition. They don't have much experience with real politics, making concessions, doing trades, mutual benefit type of calculations. So it's going to be a steep uphill learning curve for them. But I would like to be hopeful at this early stage that they can avoid a Libya scenario.
But while the leadership appears to be falling into place, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, has yet to assert control over all Syrian territory. And Israel appears to be taking advantage of that vacuum. It's carried out hundreds of airstrikes on targets across Syria, including the capital, Damascus. Lina Sinjab joins us live from Damascus now. Lina, are we getting a clear idea of what a future Syrian government might look like?
Well, for the moment, the leader of the HTS, Muhammad al-Julani, appointed an interim government. And this interim government with a small cabinet basically is to start handing over and taking over the duties from the former government. He basically said, we need to get the services running for people, for the country to start reoperating. But, you know, people watching this appointment, he basically chose.
I think we might have lost that line from Lina. We're trying to get it up again, but no, it seems that it's gone. We're going to move on, maybe try to talk to Lina again in a little while. Well, as I had mentioned, Israel has been carrying out bombing raids on Syrian targets, targeting airports and warehouses, weapons and ammunition depots. Speaking earlier today, the UN Syria Special Envoy, Geir Pedersen, criticized Israel's actions inside Syria.
A very troubling development. We are continuing to see Israeli movements and bombardments into Syrian territory. This needs to stop. This is extremely important.
We also understand that Israel has been moving further into the Golan Heights. So what's the strategic significance of them? Dr. Aaron Bregman is a senior teaching fellow at the Department of War Studies at King's College London. He also served in the Israeli Defense Force in both the 1978 and 1982 wars in southern Lebanon.
The Golan is important for the Israelis, at least, for two reasons. Number one, the mountains. You know, in the winter, there is snow on the Golan, so it is very high, and from there you can see well into Syria. Number two, there is a lot of water. This is 1967 when Israel occupied the Golan from Syria. In 1973, Syria attacked Israel and tried to recapture the Golan Heights, but then the Israelis pushed them back, and after the war, it was decided between Syria and Israel on the Golan Heights, there will be a no man's land. And the United Nations or United Nations forces will patrol this area. In the last couple of days, Israel moved into the area and reoccupied it.
So Israel spies an opportunity here. What do you think its logic is exactly?
Israel is taking advantage of the chaos in Syria. And the fact that in the United States they are busy with their own politics at the moment, and the Israelis try to take some land in Syrian territory just to defend itself from the possibility that in the future the new regime in Syria will try to move into Israel and attack them and do to them what Hamas did on the 7th of October 2023. So they are trying, the Israelis, to create a buffer zone. And this buffer zone is inside the area which in the past used to be the no man's land.
Is this a risky game, though, for the Israelis to play? Do they risk angering the incoming Syrian regime by moving forward in this way?
They do anger them, I'm sure. They are not stretching their hand in peace, but they are trying to create, you know, facts on the ground to be able to deal with the new Syrian regime for a position of power rather than a dialogue. The Israelis also in the last couple of days bombed Syria from the air and from the sea. It's not just ground operation. They are trying to destroy whatever is there on the ground in Syria, their airplanes, their tanks. They attack their military bases. It's quite a big military operation as far as Israel is concerned.
And it's not just military operations, though. We're also seeing some rhetoric coming out of the Israeli government as well. We've heard the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu say that the Golan will be part of the state of Israel for eternity. Does that add fuel to the fire?
You see, Israel in 1981 annexed the Golan Heights, saying that the Golan Heights belong to Israel. But you'll probably be surprised to hear that Netanyahu in the 1990s offered the Golan Heights to Hafez al-Assad, the leader of Syria at the time, not the son, but the father. So he, Netanyahu, was willing to negotiate the future of the Golan Heights. Now he denies it, of course. Now he's keeps saying that Israel will keep it for ever and ever. But ever is a long time, and I'm sure that the new regime in Syria will want to see the Golan Heights one day back in Syria. It is 1% of Syrian territory. There's a lot of water there. It is important for Syria.
Dr. Aaron Bregman from the Department of War Studies at King's College London. We've just looked at Israel's actions outside its internationally recognized borders in the wake of the monumental events in neighboring Syria. But as that crucial military operation is taking place, Israel's leader has been caught up in another matter. Benjamin Netanyahu has become the first sitting Israeli prime minister to testify as a criminal defendant. He's denying a raft of allegations against him. Our correspondent John Donison is in Jerusalem. John, tell us what Mr. Netanyahu is accused of.
Well, Celia, he faces corruption charges of fraud, breach of trust and bribery. They include accepting $300,000 worth of gifts, including expensive champagne and cigars, and also of agreeing to ease press regulation in exchange for favourable media coverage for one of Israel's biggest selling daily newspapers, which is run by a very wealthy media magnate. And of course, Mr. Netanyahu denies it all.
But what did he else did he say in court today? Did he give an explanation?
He did. I mean, he has basically called this a political witch hunt. He said it was an ocean of absurdity in his testimony today. He said that as the prime minister, he was managing a country that was at war. And he said he thought the court should have balanced this time better than making him testify three times a week. He denied that he had been delaying this trial, which is the accusation of his critics, of which there were many outside court today. A lot of protesters against Mr. Netanyahu facing off with his supporters and his critics, which include the families of some of the hostages still being held in Gaza, basically say that he has been prolonging and escalating the wars in the Middle East in order to avoid standing trial and possibly going to jail.
You've said that Mr. Netanyahu denied trying to delay his trial, but now that it's started, how long is expected to carry on for?
Well, it's expected he will have to testify for 2 weeks at least, and he's going to be doing that 3 days a week is what he's negotiated with the judge. He had asked for it to be less than that, but they've settled on 3 days a week. So I think that could mean it takes more than 2 weeks. And it is a time when he is incredibly busy. So, you know, it's a key moment. But I guess for his critics, this is a moment of truth to power, at least in their view. And it has to be said that Israel is not shy of jailing its leaders. We had the former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who also was found guilty of corruption charges, went to jail. And we had an Israeli president who was jailed on sex crimes charges.
You've mentioned the Prime Minister's critics. You've mentioned the protesters outside the courthouse. How is the Israeli public in general feeling about Mr. Netanyahu at the moment and about this trial?
Well, about this trial, it's divided. I mean, he divides opinion in Israel and indeed around the world. His popularity took a real blow after October the 7th because the Hamas attack on October the 7th last year, because there were many people in Israel who felt that as the prime minister, he was ultimately responsible for the military and intelligence failings that led to that attack, which was the biggest military humiliation defeat in Israel's history. There are also, as I say, the families of the hostages who say he hasn't prioritised a ceasefire and hostage release deal in order to pursue his military gains in Gaza. However, his popularity in recent weeks has surged in opinion polls, and that's because the war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has inflicted massive defeats on the Hezbollah leadership, including assassinating the leader Hassan Nasrallah, that has been much more popular. And, you know, despite all his problems, despite the fact that, as you said in your introduction, the first sitting Israeli prime minister to stand trial, he's still doing pretty well in the polls.
John, thank you. Our correspondent John Donison in Jerusalem. Coming up, the pursuit of quantum computing takes another leap forward thanks to a new chip from Google.
They have demonstrated that quantum error correction works, so that quantum computers can scale beyond what we have today. And the bigger we build them, the better they will become. That is a truly momentous achievement.
That's coming up in 20 minutes. But first, our headlines this hour. As we've been saying, Israel has continued its airstrikes on military targets in Syria. But otherwise, life in Damascus is returning to something like normal. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told a court in Tel Aviv that corruption charges against him are ridiculous. And the president's office in South Korea has announced it can't say who's running the country. Stay with us on NewsHour. This is NewsHour. Now, as we've been explaining, there's been a wave of massive explosions in Syria, including the capital, Damascus, believed to be carried out by the Israeli Air Force. And that's added to the air of uncertainty over the capital, as the leader of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and the interim prime minister say they're making progress towards a transitional government. Among civilians, scenes of jubilation are still being seen. Damascus still remains largely shut down. The BBC's Yogita Lemaye reports from the capital.
We're just entering Damascus right now. The main highway heading into it from the border with Lebanon seems pretty empty at the moment. I can see everywhere where there were posters of the former president Bashar al-Assad. They've been scratched out. I've seen at least three or four of those so far. earlier when we just crossed the border, so from Lebanon into Syria, we saw a lot of fighters, presumably from HTS, from Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, holding up their guns, firing their guns in the air, celebratory gunfire. We've also crossed some abandoned army tanks and we saw people standing on them and taking photographs. And everywhere where these rebels are waving us in, they're doing so with thumbs up signs, big smiles, and then putting their guns up and firing in the air. We've entered Damascus now. That was celebratory gunfire here at the Central Umaydia Square in Damascus. We are seeing people from all directions packed in cars coming here. This is like a street party. In front of me, I can see people standing here taking selfies, taking photos of each other, celebrating, clapping, cheering. People have come with their whole families, their children, there are women.
We are so happy here. We need Syria without Assad family, without Bashar al-Assad. We hope a good future.
What's your name?
My name is Abdul Qadir.
And how you're a student?
Yes, I'm a student.
And how do you feel today?
Free. It's the feeling of free. It's very amazing.
Freedom.
Because the people who take the decision, not anyone like Bashar al-Assad.
And what do you think is going to happen next year?
I think, I don't know, this is for the new government, but I think everything will be better.
I am Hani from Damascus.
Who's going to run this country?
Mainly for the coming days, I think Hayat Tahrir al-Sham will control this. They are organized people, as I know. Later on, we will have like temporary government to control the situation. And then we will do elections and select new president, a new parliament. This is what we need. This is what we need. And the president will come. You will rule for 4 years and then you will go. We will not wait to give it to your president, to your son, your grandson. It's not. This is not what you want.
Because of the origins of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham,
yeah.
You know, some people are worried that what you might end up with is fundamentalist, you know, Islamist rule in the country.
Yeah. I think based on the last 13 years, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham has changed a lot. They started maybe like a part of Al-Qaeda, but now they are Syrians. Purely they are Syrians. And I think in the coming days, we will see good things from these guys. They know that the dictator will destroy the country and the dictator will destroy his country. So it should be a democratic country in the next day.
What we've seen at government buildings, public places and markets is that there are rebels from Hayat Tahrir al-Sham who've been moved from Idlib, the region that they were holding, up to Damascus to secure these places. But at the moment, there is no clarity on who is running this country. When will a proper functioning new government be formed? These are questions that Hayat Tahrir al-Sham will have to answer really quickly.
Yogita Lemaye. Well, as we were just hearing there, some Syrians are hoping for elections and democratic rule. But what's the chance of that happening now that Syria is run by a conservative Islamist group? So how will Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, rule Syria? Natasha Hall is a Syria expert and senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. She joins us live now. Natasha, as we heard in Yogita's report, people say they've found freedom, but is HTS a group that can transform Syria into a democracy?
I mean, that all remains to be seen. What I can say is that Syrians have lived and died for democracy, so it would be quite difficult for any one ruler to come back and impose any kind of repressive rule again. So what we can hope for, though, is that HTS is still in a vulnerable place, even though it controls the capital. It has sanctions against it. It is a designated terrorist organization, not just by the United States, but also Turkey and the United Nations. And this is, frankly, the moment to enter into negotiations with this group to ensure, you know, good behavior, the elections, everything that the Syrians you just spoke to want for their country.
Based on what you've seen so far, what style of governance do you think they have in mind?
So without a doubt, how they've ruled in Idlib is with an iron fist. There have been people that have died in detention there. They are certainly of an Islamist leaning. That said, it is very clear that al-Jolani, the leader of HTS, recognizes the hodgepodge, the heterogeneous nature of Syria, and has assured protection for minorities. Now, we hope that protection goes along with civil rights and the ability for everyone to live their lives. But more importantly, we hope that the group dissolves, all of the armed groups dissolve into the next Syrian army or military, and that we have a civilian leadership in place.
You mentioned a short moment ago that HTS has been designated as a terrorist organization. For peace and stability and a smooth transition towards being a governing power, should they be removed from that list of that they're on the list of in many Western countries and in the outside world?
Yeah, well, this is the critical point. This is the moment to be entering negotiations with them to ensure that they meet certain steps in order to get de-designated. Al-Jolani has said that he will dissolve the organization, that all militia groups will dissolve in the new Syria. But we just hope that rebranding doesn't allow for de-designation. We need to see the types of behavior that Syrians want for their country as well.
And just briefly, can you reflect on how al-Jolani views women, how he might deal with women? We understand that HTS has issued a statement saying they won't object to women not wanting to cover their hair, for example.
Yes, I mean, this has been the case, though. I mean, for those, especially non-Muslims who do not cover their hair, I do know of religious minorities that have lived in Idlib all of this time. This is the area that HTS has governed. That said, it's wonderful to see these statements from HTS essentially telling its members to leave women alone with, you know, their attire and their look or appearance. So we need to see more of that. And we need to also have assurances.
Okay, Natasha, thank you for taking us through that. That was Natasha Hall, a Syria expert and senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Lots more to come on NewsHour. Please stay with us. Welcome back to NewsHour. The Indian multinational Adani Group, involved in construction and energy project worldwide, is facing scrutiny following a recent U.S. indictment. The company has also been accused of corruption in Kenya, where it secured contracts worth about $2.5 billion. It strongly denies the allegations. Nelson Amenya, who exposed one of the deals, says he's unable to return to Kenya, fearing for his safety. The BBC's Esther Kahumbi asked him why he did it.
I want to see a better Kenya. I want to see a better country, my home, you know, country becoming developed, industrialized, and an end to corruption. And we all have to play a part. So I was doing it for my country, and it's a big sacrifice. I am not able to go back to Kenya because obviously I have received threats and from credible intelligence agencies and people in Kenya that have warned me not to go back because obviously there are some people who are very angry with what I did and they would like to, you know, come at me.
Kenya cancelled the deal, the energy deal and the airport deal after the indictment in the US. Do you feel vindicated?
I actually feel quite vindicated because I said a lot of times this company has a record of bribery, has a record of money laundering. And also for the president to cancel the deal, then it means it was a bad deal.
You've talked about these red flags. Were they breaking any Kenyan laws?
They never did a due diligence for this company. So in the PPP Act, it says the company should not have any pending legal cases in court in the last 5 years. And also, they did not follow the due process of procurement. By July, when I was exposing this, they had not done any public participation. It was still quite secret, this deal. And at that time, they were just a month from signing the deal.
What evidence do you have that these documents are legit? Did you go through any process of verification to ensure that what you are reading was accurate?
What made the documents authentic to me was they had timestamps, they had stamps of Kenya Airports Authority, and the people who were giving me these documents were from legitimate departments of government.
Yeah. The government has denied any irregularities, corruption or bribery involved in the energy deal or even in JKA. What do you make of their denial?
It's normal. Even Adani denied, and even the indictment in the US, they have also denied. So we don't expect any less or any better.
Adani Group has dismissed Nelson's claims as baseless and malicious. A spokesperson told the BBC that no airport contracts had been signed and that both proposals were submitted following Kenyan public-private partnership regulations. The company also refutes all allegations and insinuations of any violation of Kenyan laws in their operations or proposals. The company says every project they undertake is governed by a strong commitment to compliance, transparency, and the laws of the country in which they operate. Stay with us on NewsHour. I'm Celia Hatton, and this is NewsHour, coming to you live from London. To the U.S. state of Pennsylvania now, and the focus of intense public interest after a 26-year-old man was charged with the pre-planned killing of a health insurance executive. Brian Thompson was shot outside a New York City hotel last week. It's a case that's generated a huge amount of interest in the motive behind the murder, and now in the backstory of the young suspect. Let's hear more from the BBC's Neda Tofik in New York City. Neda, tell us the latest that you're hearing.
Well, we are waiting to hear whether Luigi Mangione will be extradited to New York today or very shortly to face the charges that New York prosecutors have leveled against him, murder and other charges, including gun charges. Now, he is currently being held in Pennsylvania, of course, where police arrested him and charged him with having an unlicensed firearm. But really, the investigation now is extremely focused on how someone who, by all accounts, to those who knew him, would have been the last person they would have suspected capable of doing what he's accused of, murdering the United Health CEO, Brian Thompson. And what we know about Luigi Mangione is that, you know, he grew up in a wealthy family. His cousin's even a Republican politician in Maryland. He went to an all-boys school where he was the valedictorian of his class and then went on to have a bachelor and master's degree in computer science from an Ivy League college in Pennsylvania. What's less clear after he had a career in data science and engineering is what happened in these last few months. Now, we understand that he had suffered from a very painful back injury, which impacted his life. There's even a picture on one of his social media accounts that appears to show an X-ray of his spine with surgical implants in it. And we know that over the last few months, he told the judge in his court appearance that he had been in touch with his family until recently. We know his family had reached out to friends of his, asking if they had heard from him. We know friends had posted on his social media accounts asking where he'd been. So the focus really is on these last few months and how someone who was smart, athletic, social, could have become a suspected murderer.
Neda, how was he found?
It's incredible, really, because this all came down to someone at a McDonald's noticing him and really seeing his pictures that were put out by the NYPD, widely circulated, posters, images on news reports, and kind of connecting that person to those images. And eventually an employee at a McDonald's in Altoona, Pennsylvania, 4.5-hour drive outside of New York City, alerted the local police. And when the police came and started questioning him, he started acting suspiciously, started shaking and getting nervous. And so they quickly put two and two together that he could be the suspect. And
NYPD didn't even have him on their radar until then. That despite using drones, scuba divers in a lake to try to recover evidence, drones, canines, so many resources in this most surveilled city in the country to try to find him. But he had evaded detection until someone recognized him.
And just briefly, Nada, I mean, what are the things that he was found with? What was some of the evidence that police recovered?
Yeah, this is really critical because the police say this is what really connects him to the crime, they say. He was found with a gun, a weapon, a ghost gun. That's something that's made on a 3D printer, and also a silencer. They say that really resembled what they believe was the weapon used in the killing. They say he also had a 3-page written manifesto, handwritten manifesto, that showed ill will toward corporate America. They said it really spoke to the motivation behind the crime they're investigating. Some reports saying it referred to insurance companies as parasites.
Nada, thank you. That was the BBC's Nada Tawfik in New York City. Time to dive into the world of quantum computing and Willow, the latest development from Google that it describes as a state-of-the-art quantum computer chip. The company claims Willow leapfrogs over the supercomputers we used to consider the world's fastest. It takes 5 minutes to solve a problem that would currently take supercomputers 10 septillion years to complete. Yes, I said septillion. But does Google's new invention live up to the hype? Dr. Stefano Giorgioso is a lecturer on quantum computing at Oxford University. I began by asking him to explain what exactly quantum computing is.
Quantum computing is a way of using quantum physics, so the evolution of the smallest state of matter, like photons or electrons, to perform computations that are impossible to perform with our current computing hardware. This is definitely the future of computing. In the next 5, 6, 7 years, we'll start seeing quantum computing unlock applications that are currently impossible in material science and chemistry and optimization.
Okay, so let's focus in on what Google has unveiled. What does the Willow quantum computing chip do?
This is their newest quantum computing chip. It has 105 qubits, so a quantum bit, which sounds little, but every time you add a qubit to a quantum computer, its power increases twofold. So it doubles every time you add one. The computational power of these machines grows exponentially. And by moving from 53 to 105, Google has significantly improved the kind of computation that this machine could in principle do.
Okay, so that sounds pretty impressive. Were you impressed?
There are two things that they announced today. One of them is the results of a standard test, which is known as random circuit sampling. That is what I guess got most of the headlines, because they quoted this 10 septillion years number. That's just a test to measure the capability of their machines. It has no practical applications. It's purely a performance test. The other thing they announced, which didn't get quite as much press because it's more technical, is that they have demonstrated that quantum error correction works, so that quantum computers can scale beyond what we have today. And the bigger we build them, the better they will become. That is a truly momentous achievement. And I think that's the thing we should be focusing on.
How long will it take until we start seeing some practical applications for new developments in quantum computing?
Okay, that's a $1 billion question. I think the timelines currently are between 5 and 10 years. It could be earlier if we get certain breakthroughs. There are some players that have machines that would scale really fast. If we stick to these current timelines, I think early 2030s is the agreed time when we will start seeing practical applications that are unlocked uniquely by quantum computing.
Okay, and what are the benefits that we might see?
These machines are effectively harnessing physics itself. They are creating simulations that we can tweak. And we can take physical systems that are very hard to simulate because they are complex, because they are quantum, like chemistry. We put them in a quantum computer, and the way the quantum computer evolves, we can tweak it to perform the computation for us. So there are, for example, metal organic frameworks that can be used to do carbon sequestration that could be designed. They are hard to design today because simulating them is impossible on current hardware. You have to make certain approximations that make it hard to understand whether they will work or not once you manufacture them. But with quantum computers, we can get the actual material to behave as closely as possible to how it would in reality. And so it unlocks all kinds of new material science and chemistry and medicine down the line that we couldn't simulate today.
Dr. Stefano Gogioso, a lecturer in quantum computing at Oxford University. And you can read more about Willow, that's Google's latest quantum computer chip, on the BBC News website. Now, back in January, Norway became the first country in the world to move forward with commercial-scale deep-sea mining. That's the process of removing rock-like modules packed full of metals from the ocean floor. But just last week, the government in Oslo suspended the plan after a left-wing environmentalist party intervened. On the other side of the world, the Cook Islands, a tiny Pacific Island nation, is in the third year of a five-year exploration phase to determine the feasibility of deep-sea mining. They had been looking to Norway as inspiration for mining their waters, too. But at what cost? Our Pacific correspondent Katie Watson now reports from the island of Rarotonga.
First ever at sea peaceful demonstration.
We've just boarded a traditional vaka or canoe, and it's a fiberglass catamaran but built in the traditional style.
Kia ora, my name is Alana Matamaru Smith. I am the current director of the Epopaeia Society, a local non-government environmental organisation based here in the Cook Islands. We want to show, you know, the world that there is actually opposition to deep sea mining here in the Cook Islands, and not everyone is in support or would prefer a significant amount of time being put into this space before any big decisions are made.
Low-lying Pacific Islands are among the nations most vulnerable to climate change. With rising sea levels, the ocean remains their greatest threat, but it's also their greatest provider. They fish in it, they live off tourists drawn to their turquoise waters. Now the Cook Islands wants to dig deeper, to the ocean floor, where there are millions of rocks or nodules packed full of some of the most in-demand resources in the world: cobalt, manganese and nickel, crucial elements in things like electric car batteries and mobile phones.
Hi, Prime Minister, how are you doing?
The Prime Minister, Mark Brown, is leading the Cook Islands' push to mine the ocean. Such is life on a small island. He wears more than one hat. He's the tourism minister and the seabed minerals minister too.
They present a huge potential for our country. Countries like us, at the forefront of impacts of climate change, are struggling to find ways to build resilience against the increasing impacts of climate change in our countries.
You think you're finding a way forward that's different, but yet people are saying this is risky, you shouldn't do it.
We know that for the last 20 years, we haven't been able to get the financing from the larger emitting countries. So we've got to look to ways to how we can protect ourselves. And our seabed minerals provides an opportunity for us to be able to look at how we can potentially exploit this resource.
The Cook Islands sees deep-sea mining as giving this nation some security in an uncertain future. Future income that will give its people better healthcare, education and opportunity. The downside, though, isn't yet clear. Internationally, there's a growing call for a halt on deep-sea mining while more research is done. And this island is split.
Katie Watson in Rarotonga in the Cook Islands. And you can hear more from Katie on Assignment on the BBC World Service. Stay with us on NewsHour.
I'm Celia Hatton, and this is NewsHour coming to you live from London. Back to the remarkable events in Syria. Today, we bring you the incredible story of a man who is finally enjoying his third day of newfound freedom after breaking free from the notorious Saydnaya prison in Damascus. Suhel El-Hamawi has been behind bars in Syria for 33 years. Originally from Lebanon, he was detained for being a member of a Lebanese political party, which the Syrian regime was opposed to. He entered prison during the time when Syria had military and political control of Lebanon under the rule of Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father. Now in his 50s, Suhel last saw his family when he was just a young man. But yesterday, he made it back to his home country to be reunited with them. Let's hear from Suhel El-Hamawi in his own words.
We were aware of what was happening outside the prison, but we never thought we'd get free. It never crossed our minds. At 5:45 a.m. on December the 8th, we noticed unusual movements inside the prison. Usually, in moments of chaos, prisoners panic and tread carefully. But this time, the prisoners began banging on the doors, trying to break them open and get out. We broke a window and immediately climbed out. We ran quickly. There was no time to look back. We ran toward the main road. I reached a point where I didn't know where I was or which direction to take. Left or right, west or east, I was faced with two choices. And in either one, I could find my freedom or my death. The psychological torture was stronger than the physical torture. They didn't need to torture you physically. The mental torment was enough. If I had been beaten day and night, I might not have felt anything. But the greatest agony was feeling that my end would be here. To have no dream of tomorrow, that is devastating and hurts even more. Today, I feel like someone who wants to live. Yesterday, life and death were the same to me. Today, I love life, and I want to live.
Prisoner Suhel El-Hamawi. Well, images of Saydnaya prison have come in thick and fast since the fall of Assad just days ago. But before then, it was almost impossible to document, let alone visualize, life inside that vast prison complex. The closest anyone had come to producing an image of Saydnaya was a 3D model created by Forensic Architecture. That's a research agency based at Goldsmiths University in London that investigates state violence and human rights violations. I spoke to Christina Vervia from Forensic Architecture about what her team uncovered about Saydnaya prison.
Some of the prisons were more known, and others, like Saydnaya, there was no access by any independent investigator, any journalist, any human rights group. So we only had the satellite image from which to work from. There was no understanding of what was happening inside, other than the voices of those who managed to get out. So this was the starting point for us. We went to Istanbul and met with five of the survivors who had managed to come out. And we sat down with them and worked on a process that we call situated testimony, where we asked them to reconstruct the places of their incarceration based on their memory. So the model we have made is really a model that comes out of memory of people who have a very intimate experience of those spaces, but also a very partial one, because they were not really allowed to leave the cell. And the only experience they had of the in-between spaces was while they were being blindfolded and forcibly moved from one to the other. The in-between spaces is something that we had to approximate and reconstruct by asking them questions of sound, of the echoes that those spaces had. And all of that was through a sound reconstruction that we did with an acoustic investigator.
Christina, what was it like then for you to work on this project and then just in the past few days to be able to see photographs and videos taken from inside the prison itself for the first time?
It was completely overwhelming for us to see some of those images. We were extremely moved to see people walking free. We really did not know if this day would ever come. But then, of course, seeing some of the footage from inside the prison and the scale of the horror still unfolding, it's really hard to fathom. It feels that it's something that we have to work on for years to really come to terms with what happened there. And I think it is a historical moment. I can't believe I am experiencing it.
When you see those images, how closely do you think does the model that you created from the testimony of those former prisoners, how closely does your model align with what you are now seeing?
It is really consistent. It is incredible how well the interviewees were able to describe that space. You know, there's few details in terms of, for example, the color of the walls that is different to what we expected. But the overall arrangement, because we could understand the architecture of the building from the satellite, from the vents that were in each block of cells, we knew the dimensions of the cells quite well. So the space seems so familiar, but it's also the reality of it just gains a different granularity. And of course, what's the most moving thing to see is people walking free. This is not the experience that we were described at all. We were described a very quiet place where people were held in terror. So the atmosphere in that space is completely different from this footage.
When you interviewed prisoners, you used to ask them what they wanted to happen to the prison after it had finally closed. And what would they tell you?
So most of them didn't want to see the prison get demolished. They wanted to keep it as a museum. They wanted people to really know what took place there. They felt it's their obligation to keep that memory alive. And so the way that we designed our platform was a sort of digital memorial to that place, hoping that this day would come and that the prison would actually be closed.
Just reflecting on your work for a moment, how important is it for there to be a visual construction of a place like Sednaya Prison? Why is it so important for us to be able to actually see it and imagine what it's like there?
If you read the accounts, they're really horrific accounts of torture. But of course, seeing what it's like to be there offers a whole set of details about the mechanisms of how this violence takes place. And it allows people to connect on a different level because they could really understand how within a certain space, certain living conditions happen.
That was Christina Ravia from Forensic Architecture on documenting Syria's most notorious prison. Well, that's it for this edition of NewsHour. From me, Celia Hatton, and the rest of the team, thanks for listening.